Welcome to the Quillette Podcast, hosted on alternate weeks by me, Jonathan Kay, and by Iona Italia. Quillette is where freethought lives. We are an independent grassroots platform for heterodox ideas and fearless commentary. You are about to hear a free preview of this week's episode. To hear the full episode and to get access to all our podcasts and articles, visit us at quillette.com and click the subscribe button. And this week, our recent theme of culture war bizarro turnabout continues with yet more tales of conservatives encouraging an illiberal, my guest might even say authoritarian, approach to higher education. That guest is famed Harvard University psychologist Steven Pinker, whom Quillette readers and podcast listeners will know as a stalwart defender of classical liberal values and scholarly freedom against the encroachments of so-called woke campus culture warriors. Yet Pinker himself is deeply concerned by the Trump administration's recent strong-arm efforts to force Harvard to become a less progressive institution, including by denying Harvard the right to enroll foreign students and receive federal government research contracts. Trump administration officials are even insisting that they have the right to scrutinize the details of Harvard's academic offerings before they will relieve such restrictions. Stephen expressed his concerns about the federal government's actions in a lengthy May 23 New York Times essay entitled Harvard Derangement Syndrome, and he joined me this week on the Quillette Podcast to talk about it. Professor Pinker, thank you for joining the Quillette Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so this is an unusual situation because if I were interviewing you just a couple of years ago, it would be about the latest progressive illiberal outrage in the Ivy League, and we'd be both be agreeing about, oh, those nasty illiberal progressive extremists, why can't they just accommodate diversity of opinion? Now the shoe's on the other foot. But before we get started with the current situation, a lot of your piece in the New York Times, which I discussed in the introduction, is about establishing the fact that you, of all people, are more than aware of the problem that these heavy-handed federal government gestures are meant to address. You start off by saying that you are the author of a 2014 essay that was literally called The Trouble with Harvard.
Yes.
This is 11 years ago, which I realize is like, I don't know, 300 years in culture war time. But in those primordial days, what was the trouble with Harvard?
Then the primary focus was on the Harvard's mysterious and opaque admissions policy they call holistic admissions. I could not have anticipated that it would have become famous in a Supreme Court case because, kind of as I predicted, it's basically used as a massive way to discriminate against Asian American applicants. But it's not just racial preferences, but it favored children of alumni, big donors, athletes, musicians, activists. And I mischievously said, well, look, why don't we daydream and imagine that there'd be some way of admitting students that would not require upper middle class parents to go in a frenzy of social activities for their adolescent to burnish their teenager's CV. Oh, they got to sort clothes for the homeless. They got to gather petitions.
They climbed Mount Kilimanjaro and then played a cello performance for their Sherpas.
Stuff like that, yes. I said, imagine there was some way of just we've got this institution that's devoted to the acquisition and transmission of knowledge. It's got libraries and labs and collections and expensive star faculty. There's some reason to try to match that resource with the students best able to take advantage of it, namely students who are intellectually curious, intellectually accomplished, smart. Why don't we, wouldn't it be great if there was a magic wand that allows us to select those students? I said, well, you know, we kind of do have this magic wand. It's called standardized testing. That's why it was introduced. And so I called for Harvard to change its mystical, holistic admissions policy, now deemed to be unconstitutional, with a transparent meritocratic admissions procedure, not ruling out the possibility of adding some underrepresented minorities to the mix for various purposes, but at least to be transparent and not to hide everything in this holistic mysticism. So that was the trouble with Harvard. I mentioned other things, the fact that an elite education in the United States now is kind of a luxury cruise where academics are just one pastime. I can see this in my own classes. I'm a pretty well-known professor, and my classes, you know, I think are pretty entertaining. I have videos, I have jokes, you know, I sing, I dance. And my lecture hall is half empty within 2 or 3 weeks of semester. where are all those students who are paying through the nose to be able to hear my lectures at Harvard? You know, it's not that they're slackers. They got more important things to do, like sing in the choir and pull an oar on the crew, or do stand-up comedy, or write for the student paper, or network in various other student groups. Harvard College kind of encourages it.
Are they watching the lectures online?
No. I don't make them available online for exactly that reason.
They're just skipping class.
They're cutting class. Yeah, I want there to be fannies in the seats. Anyway, the university does not consistently spread the message that, you know, don't cut class. That's why you're here. That's why we have these expensive professors and labs and libraries and collections. Anyway, that was the trouble with Harvard. Anyway, all of this is, as you know, this is ways in which I, at the outset of this article, but, you know, just more generally, tried to establish my credibility as I'm not a shill for Harvard by any means. I have been out front in criticizing it, starting with that article, but also the article that the Boston Globe called the Steven Pinker's 5-point plan for Harvard to save itself, where the 5 points were committing to academic freedom, to institutional neutrality, non-violence or non-coercion, that is, protests can spread ideas, but they can't try to jawbone the university to do what
they occupying libraries and occupying, smashing things.
Forcibly removing deans from their offices, drowning out lectures with bullhorns, disempowering the DEI establishment.
And what year was this?
The end of 2023. And the university has actually, I don't want to say they followed my advice, I mean, they may have done it anyway, but they did implement a policy of institutional neutrality. Of course, Harvard being Harvard, we can't actually admit that we used an idea from someplace else.
This shows how the times have changed, though, because in 2014, when you wrote The Trouble with Harvard, you were pretty much going directly against the prevailing cultural trends. 2023, by contrast, you were riding the crest of the cultural zeitgeist, not knowing that just a year or two later, it would overtake you.
Yes, right.
It would overtake you at the federal level. Take me back to the Steven Pinker of 2023. Did he realize that the forces that he was promoting would be extrapolated in this radical way?
No, you know, no one expects the Spanish Inquisition, as they say on Monty Python's Flying Circus. Yeah, the idea, you know, not only was at the time Joe Biden was president.
It was a simpler time.
It always was. Times just get more and more complicated, don't they? Yeah, I know, I did not. And the way that the Trump administration is, you know, frankly, in an authoritarian manner, wants to take over universities, which is pretty much what April 11th ultimatum issued to Harvard would do. Namely, among other things, a government-approved panel would audit every unit of the university for viewpoint diversity by their lights and have the power to stack every unit with a critical mass of viewpoint diverse scholars undefined. It's just an authoritarian intrusion.
Did you have colleagues come up to you and say, "Happy Stephen, is this what you wanted?"
Did I enable it?
Yeah.
That hasn't happened. People may have thought it. The problem being that there are a large number of people who, you know, I think, you know, agreed with me, and that's not because I persuaded them. They were thinking that all along. And there are some colleagues even now who are saying, well, Harvard wouldn't change without the threat from the Trump administration.
Necessary evil to spur reform.
Yeah. The thing is that it's, you know, what he's doing, such, you know, if he leads to the expulsion of a quarter of our student body, namely those not born in the United States with visas, if he strangles all federal funding of research, if he includes other punishments such as removing the university's tax-exempt status and multiplying the tax on its endowment, this would have massive effects on the university. There would not be solutions to any of these problems.
Harvard is obviously a name-brand university, but there are dozens of fantastic research universities across the United States. Is it the case that he's sort of focused closely on Harvard simply because it's pick of the litter and places like Boston University and Tufts and University of Virginia are just strolling merrily along without federal government interference of the type Harvard is getting?
Absolutely.
You know, as Canadians, we're familiar with tall poppy syndrome, right?
Exactly.
You don't want to raise your head above the others because then you get chopped. But if you're a kind of excellent university that isn't Harvard, maybe you're putting out the word. Maybe you, I don't know, for all I know, you're getting calls, come to Penn or something like that.
Well, you know, what has happened just in the last few days since our foreign students were threatened is that one university in Hong Kong and one in Germany have said to the students, we'll give you asylum. But some of the punishment that Trump has been levying against Harvard has been levying against all universities, such as the massive cuts in funding for research, the massive cut in direct costs, the tax on university endowments is going to hurt all universities, although Harvard is being singled out.
Yeah, well, their endowment is off the charts.
Although 80% of it is earmarked for specific purposes bequeathed by the donor, and a lot of the endowment income is used to pay for scholarships for students who can't afford Harvard's tuition. We have need-blind admissions, and there really isn't enough to cover the support of research. Also, there's a massive misconception that somehow the federal government is just supporting Harvard. It's not. It's paying for research projects, and if it doesn't pay for them, they don't get done.
I'm playing devil's advocate here. You're a person on the street saying, wait a sec, you're charging students, what, $60,000, $70,000 a year to go to Harvard? You have tens of thousands of students here. Pay for your own research. Why is the federal government in the business of giving a single cent to an institution whose main product goes to let the pampered sons and daughters of upper middle class suburbanites spend 4 years on a sun-dappled paradise, skipping your lectures, or fire the administrators? You've read the articles about how this was even happening when I was at Yale in the 1990s.
Yes, well, they should do that. Although, you know, it's not enough. But the thing is that for the person in the street, why should the federal government give money to Harvard? Is that that money is paying for the research on Alzheimer's and cancer and Parkinson's and infectious disease and energy and so on. It's like saying, why should, you know, General Motors is a big corporation. Why should the federal government have to pay for cars? Or why should it pay for a wealthy highway contractor? Well, because we're providing a fee for service. We have to compete for those grants anyway. And if someone has a better proposal from the University of Wisconsin, they'll get the grant instead of Harvard professor. But Harvard professors do get a lot of grants in this competitive process. And it's not just to pay for campus maintenance or luxury dining halls. It's to buy the equipment and to pay the research assistants to do the work.
I get the sense a lot of this comes back to that infamous moment when you had the presidents of Harvard, Penn, and I think it was MIT that appeared before as a congressional committee, where they gave these really tortured, pre-prepared responses to questions about anti-Semitism on campus in the aftermath of the Hamas terrorist attacks and the Israeli military reprisals that followed. Two of those presidents are since gone, including Harvard's. How much of this is related to the anti-university sentiment that took root in that moment, and universities became strangely associated with bigotry?
I think a fair amount. Our former president, Claudine Gay, was almost a perfect storm in many people's eyes of everything that's gone wrong in the university. I like her very much. She's a colleague, and I had good relationships with her. But, you know, she was appointed as president, very thin scholarly record, one that probably would not have earned her tenure. She was Harvard's first African-American president, second female president. I was kind of proud of that, but the question is, did that go into her selection? And the answer is probably. The fact that she was then exposed as having had a track record or a number of incidents of pretty minor plagiarism, but still something that we don't tolerate in our students. And then that tone-deaf testimony in Congress when she was asked if students called for genocide against the Jews, would that violate Harvard's...
I got the sense all that was written by the general counsel.
Yes. The response, it depends on the context. Yes, well, it was, or at least a law firm that had been hired to coach her. There were multiple failures there. Obviously, she was badly coached, as we know now.
But she's the boss.
But she's the boss. That's exactly right. She's the boss, and she did not have the kind of leadership of a university, part of which is representing the university on the public stage. Including an ability to think on your feet, including some sensitivity to the sensibilities of the population. And part of the problem with that testimony is simply that, even if she was literally correct, the First Amendment does protect people calling for genocide, and Harvard is committed to the First Amendment. But still, just some bristling, some raised eyebrows, that would be horrendous, that would be shocking. We would make clear in no uncertain terms that this is abhorrent. But the First Amendment protects even abhorrent speech, blah, blah, blah.
She gave a bureaucratic response.
She is the boss, but the law firm has some blame, and the corporation, that is our board of trustees, that told the law firm to advise her.
Yeah, well, corporations don't appear before congressional panels. Human beings do. This piece you wrote in New York Times is very good. Although I have to say, in the course of setting the baseline and establishing credentials as somebody who is cognizant of all the reasons people have a backlash against Harvard, you recite examples that I'd forgotten about. And in rereading them, I was like, oh my God, quote here, the epidemiologist Tyler Vanderweel was forced to grovel in, quote, restorative justice sessions when someone discovered that he had co-signed an amicus brief in the 2015 Supreme Court case arguing against same-sex marriage. I mean, Barack Obama was elected his first term. He was an opponent of gay marriage. Last I checked, he didn't have to grovel for restorative justice.
Right. So, I mean, that was a spectacular failure that we did not have the dean of the School of Public Health say he can say what he wants. He doesn't have to apologize for it. This is not a crisis as it was treated at the time. And like, and for the president
or
to
this
echo.
One, the legal scholar Ronald Sullivan was dismissed as faculty dean of a residential house when his legal representation of Harvey Weinstein made students feel, quote, unsafe. Last time I checked, everyone has a constitutional right to a fair trial, including competent legal representation. But you go on and talk about how Harvard is not the sum of these viral woke stories. And that part resonated with me. I've spoken with Canadian scholars, and they've said to me, and these are sometimes conservatives, they tell me, look, 95% of my colleagues just want to study their subject of expertise. They don't want to bother with politics. They don't want to sign petitions about Gaza. They don't want to go to pronoun sensitivity training, but they also don't want to sign petitions protesting pronoun sensitivity training. They just want to do their work, which is the reason they got into academia. It sounds like Harvard's kind of similar to that.
That is exactly right. Perfectly put.
But we hear about the other 5% of the people making the news.
That is right. Now, one could say that it doesn't take that many people being punished for there to be a regime.
Especially if they're occupying the library and telling Jews they can't use certain areas unless they pass checkpoints,
yes,
and stuff.
That's right.
You only need a dozen thugs behaving like that to make 20,000 people feel that their university's been taken over by
rebels. No, that's right. And if what happened to Tyler Vanderweel, you know, Ron Sullivan and Carol Hooven could put a chill on everyone else, it's like, well, I better keep my head down. I don't want that to happen to me. But it is true that you can get the impression from hearing these stories that that is the regime, that there's a well understood policy that you don't cross the line and, you know, they were the ones who did cross it. It isn't, that's not the way it works. I gave a long list of politically incorrect findings that my colleagues have published and that and teach, including myself.
You're the worst offender. You're on this podcast. I mean, you know, just, you're totally unrepentant.
I published in Quillette, yes. But there's some caprice in what incidents trip a wire, go viral, bring hellfire down on the head of the person. So, you know, Carol Hooven.
She's written for Quillette?
Indeed.
About chess, of all things.
Why do some incidents become outrageous and others pass beneath the radar? That is the reality. Now, and there is the danger that if there's some low probability of cancellation, that puts a chill on everyone else. And who knows what hasn't been published out of fear.
It becomes a kind of lottery.
It's kind of a lottery, yes.
So I asked you, are there progressive colleagues who've taken you to task for maybe encouraging this backlash against Harvard? Do you have conservative colleagues or media contacts who, since the publication of this piece, has said, hey, what are you doing? We finally got some action from the federal government on this Michigas that's taken over the Ivy League. And here you are saying, oh, hey, what's going on? Hands off Harvard. Have you gotten heat from the other side?
I haven't gotten heat in the sense of people saying you shouldn't have written it. Probably because I went out of the way to be so balanced. But people have said that if it wasn't for the Trump ultimatum, Harvard wouldn't have moved in this direction.
Thanks for listening to this preview of our latest podcast. To hear the full podcast episode and gain access to all our articles and podcasts, we invite you to become a Quillette subscriber. To find out more, visit Quillette.com. That's Quillette.com and click on the subscribe button. That's Quillette.com and then click subscribe. We look forward to having you as part of our community. If you're already a Quillette subscriber, go to the FAQ section of our website and click on how to add your private podcast feed to your favorite podcast app for instructions on how to access full episodes of this podcast.